From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, September 9th, 2016. And on this day, a group of Maine police chiefs urges voters to reject a ballot measure that would legalize marijuana for recreational use, citing problems in another state where the drug is legal. A Maine hospital tackles a leading cause of death in the U.S., medical errors, by adopting safety practices pioneered by the airline industry. And putting that humble hot water heater in your basement to use as an energy storage device. Those stories and more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. The Maine Chiefs of Police Association has formally announced its opposition to a measure on the November ballot, Question 1, which would legalize the recreational use of marijuana. As Mal Leary reports, the group points to problems experienced in another state.
Most chiefs say their jobs were made more difficult by Maine's legalization of medical marijuana, and that allowing recreational use will pose a whole host of new problems. Lieutenant John Kilbride of the Falmouth Police Department has developed an educational campaign for local use by police across the state. Through speaking engagements and social media, he urges Maine voters to consider what's happened in Colorado since that state legalized pot 4 years ago.
Letting them know how this is going to affect their youth, their schools, the emergency room, the roads that they walk and ride their bikes on, the limited resources that we have to manage this. We're just not ready as a law enforcement entity to manage all the issues that Colorado is experiencing.
But Alicia Melnick of the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol says the police are mistaken in their opposition to the proposal.
The Maine chiefs of police are important members of our community, but on this policy, they're wrong. Regulating and making marijuana legal for adults is working in other states. Youth access and use of marijuana hasn't gone up.
Melnick argues that additional tax revenue would be generated under the proposal, and that the entire criminal justice system would be spared the cost and effort of arresting and prosecuting marijuana users. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, a recent study shows that medical errors are likely the third leading cause of death in the U.S. The findings by researchers at Johns Hopkins were controversial, but one of the takeaways has been that the healthcare system should incorporate lessons from aviation. The airline industry has seen a dramatic increase in safety, including fewer crashes, since adopting a set of standardized safety practices. As Patty White reports, Eastern Maine Medical Center in Bangor has spent 4 years integrating aviation-inspired protocols in an effort to improve safety and reduce medical errors.
One of the first places where EMMC applied those aviation protocols is where the stakes are often the highest, the operating room.
Our first patient is a gentleman who had a fractured dislocation of his elbow about 9 months ago.
Orthopedic surgeon David Carmack is going to remove and tighten some of the hardware embedded in the patient's arm from a previous reconstruction. It's a pretty straightforward surgery. Still, there's room for error.
Room for error in orthopedics especially is laterality, you know, the correct side, left and right.
Operating on the wrong part of the body, the wrong patient, even doing the wrong procedure is rare in hospitals, but it does happen. To prevent mistakes, EMMC started working with a company 4 years ago called LifeWings, which takes best practices from the aviation industry and adapts them to healthcare. One is a team huddle right before launching into surgery. It's called a timeout.
Are we all ready for timeout?
When the charge nurse calls the timeout, everyone in the OR stops, faces each other, and reviews what they're about to do. Dr. Carmack takes the lead.
So what we're going to do is do a revision of his internal fixation, and we'll take some hardware out. I don't anticipate any critical events or any critical blood loss.
timeouts themselves aren't new. They became a quality standard in 2004. But subsequent studies have found that timeouts really haven't done much to prevent surgeons from operating on the wrong arm or leg. Part of the problem, say observers, is because the timeouts aren't standardized. That's why EMMC sought help from LifeWings.
No drug allergies that we're aware of. He has had
a checklist posted on the OR wall lists the information that teams review before every surgery about the procedure, the patient's allergies, their medications, and it ends with a crucial statement by the lead doctor.
So that completes the timeout, and the expectation is everybody will speak up with any safety concerns or suggestions throughout the case.
That statement is important because it emphasizes the principle that everyone on the team is responsible for the patient's safety. It may sound like a no-brainer, but the chief medical officer at EMMC, Dr. James Rochek, says sometimes top-down healthcare culture can make it hard for people to speak up.
It's not unusual for someone who might be a technician not to feel that it is appropriate or the right environment for them to ask a question to a nurse or a physician just because of that difference in status, different in hierarchy.
Before, the doctors had more, like, maybe not control is the right word, but more influence.
Steve Letalian is a surgical technician.
And we feel that we have more of an influence now that they want to have our input, so it's not so scary to say something.
After working to empower employees and improve communication in the OR, EMMC started adapting LifeWings protocols in other areas.
I'm here for 521A.
Okay.
Is the patient informed that they're going?
Yes.
Excellent. My name is Frank Connolly. I'm a transporter here at Eastern Maine Medical Center.
In a typical shift, Connolly will transport between 25 and 35 patients to different areas of the hospital for x-rays, testing, and other procedures. It may seem relatively straightforward, but
handoffs are one of the biggest times for safety issues to occur.
Andrea Huntley is the program manager for LifeWings at EMMC.
It can be anything from, you know, just not knowing that the patient can't, you know, stand up, risking a potential fall,
to failing to check a urinary catheter.
That, you know, could be full, and if that tilts back, that can cause urinary tract infections.
So when Frank Connolly picks up a patient for an echocardiogram, he asks the staff nurse 7 questions, which are also printed on a business-sized card he keeps in his pocket for quick reference.
How's the mobility?
He can walk to the stretcher if you pull the stretcher into the room.
Connolly says those standard questions ensure nothing slips through the cracks.
We're not giving, you know, excellent care to one patient and then, you know, mediocre care to the next.
Though it's working well now, Connolly says LifeWings had a turbulent start. It took a few attempts to create an effective communication protocol, and some staffers were slow to get on board.
I guess I would consider myself somewhat of a resistor in the beginning.
Back in the OR, Dr. David Carmack says he bought in after he had a near miss that was caught by a new young surgical tech.
Learning about near misses and actual problems and complications that really are preventable, I kind of made that decision that there's no logical reason for me not to be 100% behind this.
After EMMC implemented LifeWings safety protocols in the OR in 2013, it recorded 10 surgical errors. The next year, it had edged downward to 9. Last year, it dropped to 1. Carmack says these tools aren't revolutionary. They're common sense. What makes them work is they're part of a set process that everyone follows. And the protocols are always being updated. The next change, he says, will be ensuring that EMMC's post-operation debrief is incorporated at the end of every surgery. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Coming up, putting your hot water heater to use as an energy storage device, and how the terrorist attacks of 9/11 changed one Maine native's life. A local council has voted to request that the state's Marine Resources Commissioner limit the number of people who can fish for lobster near Stonington and Vinyl Haven. Marine Resources spokesman Jeff Nichols says the panel wants Zone C to be changed from an open zone to a limited entry zone.
What they're proposing is the entry into that zone be limited to one harvester coming into the fishery for every harvester that goes out of the fisheries.
Nichols says those finishing their apprenticeships would be put on a waiting list. Zone C is the last open lobster fishing zone on Maine's coast. Nichols says under this scenario, anyone who completes their apprenticeship requirements can start fishing. The Portland Press-Herald is reporting that with landings and prices both high, local lobstermen worry that outsiders are coming to the area to cash in. And now to the struggle over dealing with the unpredictability of renewable energy sources. While renewable energy now makes up nearly 10% of New England's mix, you can't control when the sun shines or the wind blows, and that means that sometimes extra renewable energy is dumped or a wind plant is told to shut down. As part of the New England News Collaborative Energy Series, The Big Switch, Vermont Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson reports on a startup that's hoping it can use a humble appliance in your basement, your water heater, as an energy storage device.
Okay, first to understand just how dramatically renewable energy is changing the grid, here's how the grid has worked for the past 100 years. It was sort of like the world of television in the 1950s when there were only a handful of channels.
Tonight, from the Ed Sullivan Theater on Broadway.
Back then, all the programming was coming top-down from a few broadcasters. Well, that's how the electric grid has worked. Grid operators scheduled when to turn on several large power plants to send energy down wires into homes. But now the grid looks more like the internet. Use is unpredictable, sporadic with big spikes, and anyone, seriously, almost anyone, can upload their own content.
Oh my gosh, it is a double rainbow. I cannot believe it.
And the grid's turning into that. Homeowners can put up solar panels and then send that energy back onto the grid from all over. And it just wasn't built for that. For an example, let's go someplace sunnier than New England, a place where there were all kinds of financial incentives for renewable energy.
So solar panels popped up all over Hawaii. And that idea of power flowing the wrong way, that happened. And it caused fuses to break and blackouts to happen in Hawaii. The system was just stressed very, very quickly.
That's Mass Almasalki, an electrical engineer at the University of Vermont. And he says it's not just the backwards flow that's challenging, but wind and solar are sporadic and unpredictable. They can't just be turned on and off whenever we need power. But his startup is trying to flip the paradigm. Here's Almasalki's colleague and co-founder, Paul Hines.
The big idea is that when there's energy available, you should use it. And when there's not energy available, you should not use it. Should wait until a better time. And so that's the big idea that we're trying to solve.
On its face, it's a simple concept. Almasalki, Hines, and two other co-workers are developing software that would allow common home appliances to effectively store these sporadic bursts of energy that come from wind and solar. But all without the homeowner noticing any difference. Everything would still work when you flip on the switch. They're starting by programming that big tank in your basement, the ubiquitous water heater.
Basically, kind of using this as a virtual battery. So it's like taking all these water heaters and turning them into batteries that can store the electricity, store surplus electricity from the grid.
Right now, water heaters turn on and off at pre-programmed times to stay warm. And, of course, it turns on after you take a shower to heat back up the tank. But what if your home devices were smart? What if your water heater could respond to a signal from the grid and turn on just to absorb some extra energy because all of a sudden it got sunny and solar power surged? Then, later in the day, during peak electricity use time, it wouldn't need to turn on. It would still be hot.
We're basically designing a new system that would be much more flexible than the current approach, whereas instead your water heater is in charge of its own heating. It's just checking with the grid to see whether it's a good time to run or not.
You might be thinking, okay, big whoop, a smart grid could change when my water heater turns on. Who cares? The thing is, when your water heater is heating up, it typically uses 3 times as much energy as your whole house. That's a lot. What if we could ensure that it mostly ran during times with high solar energy or wind? Andrew Giroux is an engineer with the startup, and he's working on just that. Here in their makeshift lab, a small windowless basement office, he's currently programming a much tinier version of your home water heater.
So right here we've got a shelf, 8-foot-long shelf, with all these fluorescent green electric tea kettles,
all powered off of a single outlet.
Giroux is rigging up tea kettles to test the complex software algorithms where your water heater can request energy from the grid, and the grid can tell your water heater, use this energy now.
If you plug one tea kettle into your outlet, you're good. If you plug two tea kettles in, you will trip the breaker. And we're working to make it so that all 10 can get the electricity that they need without tripping the breaker.
And it's getting hot and steamy in this tiny room, which means it's working. For the most part, there are still some bugs to be worked out. The University of Vermont professors received a competitive grant from the Department of Energy to study all this. And in a year or so, they're hoping to be ready to work with utility Green Mountain Power to actually retrofit some water heaters in people's homes and test the software in the real world. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
And Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. One Maine native has particularly vivid memories of the events. Chet Lunner is a former editor of the now-defunct Portland Evening Express newspaper. When the terrorist attacks occurred, he was out of journalism and working for the federal government. 9/11 changed the course of Lunner's life. He would go on to help design the new Transportation Security Administration and later become Deputy Chief of Intelligence for the Department of Homeland Security. Lunner shared his thoughts about that day and its aftermath with MPBN Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz.
On the morning of 9/11, I was the press secretary to the Secretary of Transportation in Washington, D.C., Norman Mineta. I was standing outside his office, as a matter of fact, waiting to see him as he was having a meeting with some visiting officials from overseas when we saw on the news channel the first plane hit. You know, this wasn't really within our experience, so we thought it was a general aviation accident that some poor guy in a private plane had misjudged something. But then it became clear it was an airliner. Then the second plane hit. Then in those seconds, all our lives changed.
Is there a single biggest change that we made that has helped to avoid further attacks like 9/11?
I would argue that the National Network of Fusion Centers, which were invented by DHS, are a big step forward. Not fully realized yet, and everything could use some improvement. But in terms of the nature of your question, on 9/11, if the Secretary if anybody in Washington wanted to alert a governor or the head of the Maine State Police or the California Highway Patrol that there was some serious intelligence coming across, there was no way to do that. We at least now have an instant way for any state to communicate with any state at a classified level in real time, for any governor to receive classified briefings or any appropriate official using this new network of fusion centers.
15 years is, of course, a fairly long time. And you've said that you've noticed a change in the perspective among the public during that time. How so?
Immediately after 9/11, there was, of course, you know, we'd been sort of sucker punched. It was an awful wake-up call, and people were, in ways that they hadn't been probably since World War II, reacting in a deeply patriotic, all-hands-on-deck manner. One of the examples I use is that the first TSA screeners whom I met as we were standing up the agency would invariably talk about, you know, their patriotic duty, and they wanted to help protect the country. And today, the most recent time I had an opportunity to talk to a TSA screener, and I usually chat them up as I go through the airport and thank them. This fellow said that he had joined for the health insurance. And so at some level, the mission has become a job. Now, it still gets done, but that's just an example that even inside the operational framework, this sense of a nationwide patriotic responsibility has really softened.
That isn't too surprising, isn't it? I mean, it's 15 years is kind of a long time, if you will, for the country to be on that kind of a hair-trigger response, if you will, to an event.
I don't disagree, and it's obviously human nature, but it does put a different tone generally on the whole atmosphere. I was speaking with a federal air marshal the other day, and he mentioned that they are now hiring people who were 4 years old on 9/11. Mm-hmm. So they just have a completely different perspective.
Does it affect, do you think, the ability to do that important job of protecting the U.S. from a future attack?
It does indeed, because as the state of Maine is about to re-energize the See Something, Say Something program that DHS has been trying to promote for a number of years, where citizens are urged to, you know, be responsible citizens. And if you see some suspicious activity, report it so that the experts can take a look at it and see if it's indeed represents a threat, or add it to other information that they have and, you know, looks for trends and analysis. That See Something, Say Something spirit again gets weaker and weaker as if you don't re-energize it periodically. And that weakened, that's really the best of all the satellites and, you know, surveillance and gadgets and miracle software that we've got. The two eyes of a citizen are still our best defense against any of these threats.
That's Maine native Chet Lunner talking with Erwin Gratz. Lunner says he has no special plans for this 15th anniversary of 9/11, but says he does expect to attend the Catholic Church's Blue Mass, a now annual recognition of the contributions of first responders. And you can hear more of Erwin's interview with Lunner on our website, mpbn.net. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Slowly but surely, drier air will gradually displace the oppressive tropical humidity overnight. Starlit skies top to bottom. Temperatures at dawn, upper 40s north, low 60s south, and lowland fog is likely. Best weather tomorrow, the northeastern corner of the state, where sun will hold out until late afternoon. An overcast will be in place across southwestern Maine by noon, central and down east counties by mid-afternoon, 70 statewide, coolest along the coast. A notable front will churn through Maine early Sunday, propelling a bevy of showers and thunderstorms ahead of it. By midday, skies will clear west and south, but not until late afternoon along the New Brunswick border. Breezy and drier, upper 60s to low 80s north to south. Monday, spectacular. Other than filtered sun across the county, a dazzling and crisp day, 70 to 79 north to south. Tuesday, a sunny start, cloudy finish north, sunshine in control for a majority of Maine. Mid-70s to mid-80s north to south with cooling afternoon sea breezes. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Friday, September 9th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Mal Leary, Patty White, Kathleen Masterson, Erwin Gratz, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.